Open loops. Do, do. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. You must listen to the open loops, a theme park for absurd beliefs and systems of integration between the mind and the creative spirit. Open loops.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Open Loops with Greg Bornstein, Conversations That Bend, a late night talk show for your unconscious mind. That's right. This is an experiential podcast, the goal of which is to stimulate your brain. How do we do it? Well, my name's Greg Bornstein. I'm a transformational entertainer and cultural hypnotist, and I want to challenge your existing belief systems by sharing with you and bringing on guests with radically unique ideas, ideas that will cause you to force your brain to expand a little bit and ultimately stimulate your mind in a way that forces you to step into the highest version of yourself. Yes, it's all possible. It's like a theme park for your intellect and imagination. We call it looping because what's an open loop? It's an unconscious provocation. Thus, you are now here to have your brain provoked and to have your world expand. Today's guest, Bruce Williams, does that quite well. I quite enjoyed this conversation with Bruce. Why? Well, because it went all over the place. Bruce is in the coaching, I suppose you could say, facilitating, workshop leading, corporate space, working with people on their communication, as well as leadership skills, bringing people together. And while on the surface, yes, that sounds as if it's perhaps, you know, a little mainstream, right? A little too mainstream for this show. It's not, because the truth, the vulnerability, the empathy that is required to develop these human skills, Bruce really dives deep into that. And he is honest in a way that, well, I've not even had some guests on the show be honest before. I didn't know where the conversation was going to go. I didn't know that there would be a story about fathers and racism and strippers involved. I mean, we go all over the map here. And at the end of it, I feel that you're left with a message of meaning that will make you feel as if you can go into any profession and still do something worthwhile for the good of yourself and the good of humanity. Big testament, however, Bruce Williams delivered. I really enjoyed the conversation. Feel free to share this podcast with anybody looking for some inspiration. And make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts and leave a review, leave a rating, just so we can keep getting these types of dialogues out there. Without further ado, here he is, the founder of Easy Teams, Bruce Williams. Bruce Williams is here on Open Loops. He works with business leaders, CEOs. He is, well, his day job is this kind of corporate consulting stuff, but today on this program, Bruce Williams has joined me to explore the next stage in his life, perhaps. This book concept he told me about, the universe in my sandwich. And I'm curious to explore your journey from being a recovering academic to an aspiring beach bum. I mean, you've got a lot of facets, Bruce. So we're going to go down these different rabbit holes, chase the loops. First off, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Greg, it's absolutely my pleasure to be here. Yeah, big fan of your work. I love the conversation you had. They're just so, you know, Open Loops is such a fabulous name for the podcast. But just because I love your curiosity and the questions you ask. I think the quality of our life is determined by the kinds of questions we ask, and good questions make for a great life. So yeah, really happy to be here. Thank you.
Oh, of course. Of course. Yeah. You know, what's interesting is that I know that your journey, you've had a lot of downtrodden times when you were broke, times when you were struggling. And then I'm sort of curious about, well, I suppose I could go there, but I feel like you did those podcasts. The podcast that people listen to typically with someone that is doing your day job is the, I was down on my luck. I could not figure out how to actually make something of myself. And now I talk to corporate consultants about the interpersonal skills that you need to survive in work, but in your life. I don't want to do that podcast because I want to know where you're at in terms of you're now moving towards personal coaching and just interested in transitioning to new areas. First off, how's the corporate world been? And second, why are you going in a more, I don't know, human to human personal direction rather than zoning in on where the money is?
Money comes and goes. It's a way of keeping track of some things, but it's just a medium of exchange. I guess I've always been interested in helping people maximize the enjoyment of their own life, which could be to develop their potential or to find something that really lights them up on the inside. I think everyone deserves to love what they do and do what they love. Whether that's being a CEO of a multi-million-dollar company or making the best chocolate muffins in the tri-state area, it doesn't right. matter. Well, what lights you up on the inside? You know, this is that dance, is it art, is it writing, is it public speaking, or whatever it is. It could be, you know, making leather utility belts for people that like leather utility belts. But if that's your craft and your art and you want to give your heart to it, then why shouldn't you be able to? So I'm not attached to money and things. It's come and gone lots of times, like you said. How's the corporate world? I think it's struggling, and certainly this year, huge challenges for so many people. And I think that's a part of the shift for me is in this year, my own business, you know, virtually 90% of it disappeared overnight.
Right.
A lot of, you know, public speaking, face-to-face workshops, that sort of thing. So how do you go, okay, and you can kind of handle that if it's your own fault, but when it's not, you go, I didn't do this. How come it's happening to me?
Yeah.
So then you have to question, all right, well, what am I doing this for? Who am I doing this for? Who do I want to be in this space? And, whatever we're attached to, if we think our joy, our selfhood, our being comes from those things, whether that's family or work or our spirituality or whatever, if those things are external to us, then they can come and go, and then we're open to those fluctuations of, oh, who am I? You know, I don't think there is such thing as work-life balance. It's all this life. The balance has to be on the inside, regardless of what we're doing.
Yeah. I mean, do you think you would have come to it anyways? Because this is what I have encountered, and now you brought something up to me, or at least you sparked a line of thinking in my thought about the way that we've heard people responding to this pandemic. And that is, hey, I worked this corporate job and things were really nice and I had everything going for me. And now that I couldn't do the things that they told me working in a nice cushy job were going to give me, I'm now forced to be with myself and reevaluate and decide what's truer to the things I want to do. And now when I'm hearing it from your angle, you lost business, but how sad would it have been if you didn't lose business, but everybody else did, and you lost the chance for that awakening moment? Do you think you would have had a shot? Say you didn't lose the business, but you saw everybody else around you. Would you have come to that moment of, I need to start exploring other stuff too? Or do we have to rely on circumstance? What is your spiritual understanding of that?
That is such a great question. I think there is something within us, this sense of calling and destiny that we all carry, right? It's a blueprint that's there. And we become dissatisfied, whether we're successful or unsuccessful, that sense of there's something else. What is that thing that keeps coming up? And, you see people that hugely successful in the usual kind of status sense of money and wealth and income and you know, all the toys. And yet they reach this point of deep dissatisfaction in that space, again, because that life balance isn't internalized yet. So I think we're constantly searching for that, and the external fluctuations, the ups and downs, they're clues. We get feedback from that, but I think there's still that internal feedback that's happening. Our own thinking is giving us feedback. Our own emotional responses to things are giving us feedback. Our psyche, and then our social connections, and then life itself. You know, shit happens. All of these things are just feedback. And then how do I react to that? Again, is telling me, where does that align with what I really believe about myself and who I am? I think if you've ever read the book by, I think it's M. Scott Peck, The Road Less Traveled, he talks about two really fascinating kind of origin myths. In Greek mythology, the gods all get together. And so when a soul is about to be born, the soul speaks with the fates, and they have a conversation about, you know, okay, this is what you're going to do with your life, and this is how it's all going to be mapped out, and where you live, et cetera, what you do, your skills, talents, abilities, and your weaknesses and strengths. It's all decided. And great, I've got the blueprint for my life. Then the soul crosses the planes of forgetfulness and forgets everything and is born. And so it's born with this sense of, I'm here to do something. And I know, you know, so it's this kind of not predestination, but a predilection towards certain things. And so our life is bent towards trying to find those things. In Jewish mythology, there's a similar story where the soul meets with God and has the same conversation, the same outcome. And then an angel comes and touches them just below the nose here, right? Which is why we had that little groove under our nose, right? That's where the angel touched us.
Yeah, I wonder what that is.
And we forget. And so, again, the soul is born forgetting that conversation, but aware that there's something here I'm meant to be doing, which is why then we do this. Why am I here? You know?
Yeah.
So I think that why am I here question comes up. Those are the two fundamental questions, right? It's often attributed to Mark Twain, the two most important days of your life, the day you're born, the day you find out why. It wasn't Twain that said it. It was actually a woman that wrote a book for other women. About mastering their lives. And she said, these the two most important days of our lives, the day we're born, the day we find out why. What is that why? That why is to make a contribution. So the fundamental questions there are, who am I and why am I here? And so that's what we're constantly trying to answer. That's the open loop for all of us, right, is who am I and why am I here? And so COVID gives us a beautiful space to explore those questions, because the normal distractions are not available to us. And we can sink into, you know, binge watching Netflix or alcohol or binge eating, you know, whatever. We'll begin to consume to try and get away from those questions because they're uncomfortable.
Yes.
But if we explore them, you know, what's out there? What's in there?
Yeah, this is raising the big philosophical question I have, is that when you're a corporate, if you die a corporate coach or consultant, Are you dying happy?
Well, some of them are, because that's the space they want to play, right? And they're very good at it. But I mean, look at someone like Brené Brown. She's working with people in that space, but she's bringing the humanness that lacks in that space back into that space. Right?
Yeah.
The idea of vulnerability and leadership and being truly authentic about what we're thinking and feeling, but in a compassionate way, that's still directed towards creating some kind of corporate success, and that's okay. We need those sorts of organizations. They employ a lot of people. They do a lot of good. They do some harm, but they also do some good.
Yeah, I mean, I guess society is always based on forming some sort of, even, you know, as primitive as you go, going back historic, these groups of people that gathered together came up with systems. What is a corporation beyond just a high level version of those systems? So they're, if you're the organizer of those systems, whether it's prehistorically or now, you have an important role. And if you just happens to be the caveman that comes in and, you know, teaches you how to, I don't know, hold a fish over a fire without needing to beat the other person in the head with a stick, that's a good role.
Yeah.
Like, that's a corporate, that's kind of what you're doing at a very reductionist level.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that if you look at our evolutionary transition from just the survival mentality and, you know, every person for themselves, and you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs at the base level, it was, you know, food, shelter, sex for reproduction, clothing, those basic needs. But then above that, beyond survival, then we go to security, where now I have certain things that I want to make sure I keep these things, you know. And so for us, contemporary life, it's a house, it's a car, it's a job. That, so now I'm not just surviving, but I have some level of security. But it's still all me-centered. Then we go above that. The next level of need then is social connection. And there's an evolutionary purpose for that, because if we are part of a tribe, we all survive better. We all have greater security. So there's a reason for that social connection to develop. And but then within the tribe, we recognize certain people have different skills. And so the next level of need is for my skill set to be recognized and valued in the tribe. And so now I have social status. But even here, this is still a little bit me-centered. And then at the top of Maslow's hierarchy, we had self-actualization. But this has gone beyond just about me and me belonging and being part of a tribe and recognized as part of a tribe. This is where now my life is actually meaningful. So this is still that me-centered, but it's meaningful because I'm contributing, because I am part of this tribe. And we start to go, you know what? This is a really cool place to be. As Viktor Frankl talked about, the question is not what is the meaning of life, but what is meaningful for my life? How do I make my life meaningful? You know, and again, if that means making leather belts or muffins or coaching corporate CEOs, whatever that is that lights you up on the inside and gives you a sense of purpose and meaning, then that's cool. Go ahead with that.
See, this makes me just feel like I'm hacking the pyramid. I have deep conversations with people, but I don't know how to make coffee.
Right.
I'm like, okay, this guy, I've got some stuff on the steps. I need to climb this ladder, learn the basic steps, because I just jump right to the top. But that said, sure, it's functional. I guess for me, it's interesting that I speak right to those needs, or at least I want to speak right to the self-actualization place. And it's often why in my corporate experience, I've talked about it on this show a lot, what is looping? Looping to me is the ability to go from working on a spreadsheet to quickly bringing in a Joseph Campbell reference and then going back to the worksheet and fusing it together intellectually just to give my life, just to give it light and color and joy. Yeah. Sometimes I feel like, some big corporations kind of trick you into feeling they're giving you all these other resources, but really making sure that you're hitting the numbers. Have you ever really met a spiritual corporation? What's your experience with that?
Yes-ish. I guess if we're talking about businesses that have a corporate soul, where they genuinely care about the people that work for them and with them, and they genuinely care about their clients and their customers' well-being, not just about making the next dollar. But so I don't think it's irreconcilable to bring those two things together to provide a service that people value to pay money for. But that service is adding quality to people's lives, right? And whether that's creating a beautiful culinary dish for someone to enjoy at a really high-priced restaurant, or whether that's making a very basic meal for a soup kitchen somewhere that's supporting the homeless. They're both the same thing. They're bringing value to people's lives, and that's, I come back to, who am I? That's a big question, but why am I here? That purpose question, I think, is very simple. It's three words. People get so hung up on what's my purpose. Our purpose is to make a contribution.
I love that. That's really great.
Right? Why am I here? To make a contribution. That means I am serving my tribe, and I'm benefiting from that. So it's that feedback loop of I'm contributing, but the tribe is contributing to me. And so there's that mutual reciprocal engagement, reciprocal transfer of energy, which could be money, it could be love, it could be hugs, it could be food, right? It's all energy. That can be done in a corporate space. I have worked with some businesses like that, and I have worked with others where it's just about making the dollars. Yeah. I'm very fortunate that now I know how to pick those people. I don't like to work with those people, so I don't. I'm in that fortunate space of doing what I love in ways that I enjoy with people that I like. So yeah. And I think there's more people moving in that direction. So it's a slow tide, but it's going to come in.
Yeah. And I was going to say, as much as you're looking into other sorts of work, I want to dig in to some of the stuff that you talk about, because what hooked to me, what really got me intrigued, Bruce, was I was reading on your about page at, I know you're not pushing this, but if you want to know a little bit about where Bruce comes from, easyteams.com.au, you were talking about, I love this. I love that you're about teaching others what makes people tick, which, understanding how other people tick, we work together with less stress, more yes, all stuff that I am intellectually engaged in terms of studying persuasion and hypnosis and subconscious communication, all that stuff that I love, that's just juicy, interesting, fascinating. But then I see you've got the assessment tools, and we've got Myers-Briggs, emotional intelligence, values, like a values assessment, all these different things. I mean, look, you have all the assessment tools on your page. They're DISC profiles. They're all the things. I mean, when you have so many of them, do they ever conflict with each other? How do you feel like all these various assessments go together and form a complete picture for you?
I got to tell you, they're a Trojan horse, right? I actually, if people come to me and say, yeah, hey, we want to do some MBTI with our teams and do some personality profiles, my goal is to talk them out of it.
Really? That's fat. So you have all these tests, but you like hope that they don't actually end up doing them.
Yeah. My preference is not to, because,
I love that. This is great. Already. Why?
why?
I love it.
Because no survey can tell you who you are, right? All surveys are wrong. They're useful in some ways, but they're all wrong because, in some respect, right? Because you can do the same survey on different days and get different results. If you're tired, if you're not well, if you're on holidays, if you're at home, if you're in the workspace, your mindset will shift and you'll respond in different ways because of the information that's sitting in front of you. The other thing I do find, and particularly in the corporate space, is these assessments are used. They're done, and everyone says, "Great, that's it. I know what I am. I'm a high D on the disc, I'm an ENTJ, in Myers-Briggs or whatever." And so now this becomes used either as a weapon or as an excuse. So now we can blame people for their behavior because that's your personality type. I get it. You can't help it. Or deal with it, buddy. You know, I'm just a high D. Right. So how is that helpful to anyone? Right. I would rather, what I do is try and talk people out of that and say, well, let's look at human behavior from a different perspective, because all these profiles actually do is tell us what we're thinking in that point in time, right? We spoke a little earlier about this, the infinite now.
Yes.
Each one of these profiles is kind of like a dashboard on your car. Depending where you're driving, how fast you're driving, how much fuel's in the tank, where you're going, that dashboard is going to give you a certain reading. But if you said, okay, this is me, it's just a snapshot of that moment of your journey. That's what these profiles are, right? They give you a snapshot. But we know psychologically, there's an arc in our life journey where our personality changes, it adjusts. We're still, our core self is still the same, but our behaviors adjust and change depending on our social context, our relationships, our experiences, whether we go through trauma or not. These things have an impact of how we begin to behave. So how can we label that as a personality type? So I'm interested in exploring human behavior, and I often talk about the patterns in human behavior that are very easy to recognize. And that's how we can, right? So, you can have a conversation with someone. People are always telling us who they are. If we just pay attention, we just listen, right? You're great at this. You listen to people, you ask them questions, you're drawing out who is this person, what are they like, what are they interested in. If we just did that in normal conversation, right, you just listen to some people and they'll tell you who they are, what they're interested in, where their value set lies. You listen to people, how people say hello, right? Like your corporate CEO that's, walking through the office, what's he say? Morning, afternoon, evening. Why? It's a statement of fact, right?
Yeah.
I understand I need to make a social greeting here. This is called upon. This is a very logical, fact-based thinker. And so the way they greet people is, this is the time of day, morning, evening.
Right? Yes, yes.
So this person, they love logic and they love facts, and that's how they're going to operate. And if you want to persuade this person, you need to come with evidence and details to persuade this person, because they're a logic-based person. Someone else comes into the office and they, hi, how are you? Good morning. So good to see you. How's your day going? Right? Different vibe, different energy. What are they telling you? I'm a people person. I'm much more interested in relationships and empathy and connection as the first point. Let's connect first and then let's have a conversation about work.
Right.
So this person, I don't need to convince them with evidence. If I want to persuade them, I need to persuade them tapping into those things that they value, which is around cooperation, collaboration, relationship, harmony. Right? So even you can take any kind of conversation. People are telling us who they are all the time if we pay attention. That's what I'm more interested in teaching people.
Yeah.
How do we do that on a daily basis and make it part of our understanding of human nature, so we stop labeling other people, which then, we get pissed off at them, or labeling ourselves and we get pissed off at ourselves. So that's stressful, right? Everyone wants to be loved and appreciated for who they are, not who they should be. So if we can eliminate those shoulds, if we can stop shoulding on ourselves, right, and shoulding on other people, right, life gets a lot easier. It gets a lot less complicated, and we can connect and communicate more effectively.
Do you imagine you're going to carry that with your work outside of the corporate space, your interest in persuasion and powerful communication? I think these are very good, great tools for making an office function, and even, in interpersonal relationships, stuff like that, with a loved one or stuff like that. But how important is that kind of training of people in a way, or just getting people familiar with what's in front of them, going to be important as you're expanding what you do beyond just in an office?
That's life. Was it Malcolm Gladwell or might have been Daniel Pink? Yeah, selling is human, right? We're always in that process of trying to get for ourselves some kind of advantage by connecting with people. We're all trying to get away from pain and towards pleasure. It's human nature. And so we're trying to find the things that we find pleasurable and enjoyable. And that can be in our love life, our personal relationships, our long-term relationships, family. That can be in the spiritual sphere as well, right? How do we understand spirituality? I have this theory that we are made in the image of the gods that we make. And so depending what kind of God we imagine, we now create ourselves in that image, right? So if we have a very small, mean-minded God, we become very small, mean-minded people. I think that's part of the problem with a lot of the religions is their presentation of spirituality is something very narrow. We see conflict coming out of that. Will I carry these ideas forward? Yeah, absolutely, because it comes back to that fundamental question, who am I, why am I here? If we can be at peace with who we are as an individual, we're less prone to wanting to try and defend that space, right? It's just, okay, I'm okay. I'm perfectly imperfect. I'm flawlessly flawed. We're all a work in progress in some way, shape, or form. Moving towards some better representation of who I really feel I am. And we're exploring that in relationships, in careers, in intellectual pursuits, in spiritual pursuits, maybe in the way we, work out and how we do that, our social connections. It's all a part of life. They're all just manifestations of us being human. I think that's the thing, I'm 61. I actually started life, I didn't mention this to you, but I my first career was actually as a church minister, which I did for 17 years until I burnt out. And that was my first occasion of going, well, who am I and why am I here? There's not much market for ex-ministers. And so that's when I went to university and I thought, wow, this is... I love this intellectual space. It's very similar to what I've been doing in the sense that you had lectures and tutorials and study. So I was used to that idea of a big meeting once a week and then smaller meetings with little groups to talk about ideas and then study and trying to work out what things mean. And so I moved into that space and became an academic. I did for a long time. But then that became constraining. And so I moved into what I do now. In the corporate space, but in each of those iterations of my life, it's been about trying to find ways to understand who we are, why we're here, and then help people feel more comfortable with that, whether that's from a spiritual perspective, an intellectual perspective, or now trying to bring both of those things into a business space, and whether that's a corporate or a group of local dentist practices who are trying to figure out how to be better at that, and help people with their dental hygiene or physiotherapists or, I work with some really fascinating people.
Yeah. Who's the most, I want to know, who's the wackiest you've,
How weird does it get? I think everybody's pretty weird,
Is there a profession? I never thought in my time. I was a minister and I did not think I'd be working at this adult video convention. Something like that, something out there that.
I did for a period of time. I was doing some business coaching with an exotic dancer. And so her space was working in strip clubs and working with exotic dancers and strippers. And in that very adult space, but they're facing the same issues that corporate leaders are, right? Anxieties about how do people perceive me and am I good enough in this space? Comparing myself to other people, and it's the same human issue no matter where I go. At the other end of the scale, I love working with lawyers because they're just so in their head. And so, it's all about these kind of legal and academic precedents and they're just up here all the time and yet they're struggling with all the stuff that's down here in their chest in their heart space and they're trying to avoid that
Are you really speaking to that with lawyers? How does that go? Oh, and by the way, we're going to get back to exotic dancers. Don't think you're off the hook with that. But I mean, are you speaking to that with lawyers? I really feel like some lawyers, at least in the United States, and this is why I am always, I need to go to Australia or the UK where they're exploring these psychological things and spiritual things. How are you talking to a lawyer about heart space? That to me feels like it is difficult.
I gotta say it's challenging. And I did a workshop recently with a group of about 50 lawyers. But they're a fascinating bunch because they are in a head, they just ask the really tough questions that really put you on the spot. But we were talking about emotional intelligence and why the stresses that they're experiencing in the workplace are because of their humanness. And so bringing that to their attention and reminding them that, you know, the anxieties that they're feeling are important feedback that if they don't listen to, it's going to begin to be detrimental for them and impact on their business. So the end is like, you want your business to be successful. Well, hey, you got to recognize how human you are in this space.
That is so good. That's so good, because that is someone that I studied. I'm dropping a big name here. Kendrick Cleveland, who is a persuasion, right. Persuasion NLP guy in the U.S. He talks about really kind of using values and criteria as a way of getting the sale. And what you're speaking to is exactly that. Okay, what is going to make their heart light up when you speak to them, which is business, money, bottom line. And then his whole thing is like, you're redefining what the criteria mean. So you're still using the same words and the same things that light them up, but you are a skilled coach, a skilled persuader is readjusting the definition of it while still hitting that word. So it's still like lights them up, but it's also, oh yeah, I never thought about how having this conversation would 10x my income this month with another coworker. Like being this human could actually do this. So that's very skillful. Did you ever come in from this heart-centered place and people just shut you down? Did you experience that early on where, or did you really have to learn these skills to get that in? Like, what are some of your early encounters? Because maybe you were just a natural empath and you could sense these people needed to hear that stuff. But I'm curious if you hit roadblocks and you're like, okay, it's not going to work when I show up like this.
Interesting question. I don't know that I am a natural empath. That's the thing for me. I'm often perceived at the other end of the scale.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. This is
what
the weird
is the other
thing,
end?
Right?
Psycho? Socio?
Well, yeah. Narcissistic sociopath, right?
People perceive you that way. I don't think you are that, but people perceive you that way.
and that's it, right? It's all perception. There's no such thing as reality. Everything is just perception. So what we're doing is about helping shift people's perceptions about what they're experiencing.
Yeah.
But for me, you know, I was often described as having a heart of gold, as in cold, hard, and yellow. I got four daughters, and this is probably why I burnt out as a minister, because I didn't understand to the degree that I do now. At least I certainly didn't understand the emotional impacts on people of certain decisions and ways of operating. And I can see an answer. And I said, well, you just got to do this. And not understanding that they had sitting behind their inaction was fear and anxiety and concern and worry. And if I don't speak to that, they're not going to take action. And then because they don't take action, I'm going to judge them for not taking action. So it just gets worse, right? I had to learn that. And we have so many rabbit holes.
I know. I'm still keeping an eye on the early stuff. Don't worry. But yes, no, this is interesting. I mean, that's a huge lesson to learn empathy. How did it happen for you? Do you recall it?
Yeah, I think it's kind of crept up on me, really. I'm like, oh, okay, I kind of understand this stuff. But really, what's fascinating, and here again, you know, there's assessment tools, right? I've done two ASD tests the spectrum tests. And I come out at sort of 92% on the spectrum in both those tests. And I thought, wow, that's pretty weird. But then I think, yeah, I was a pretty weird child. And when I think back to my childhood, I think, yeah, that was pretty strange. And I didn't make social connections. Well, I lived with a lot of social anxiety. I lived in a home where for a long time, particularly when I was a child, my stepfather was quite aggressive, very loud, drank a lot, smoked heavily, lived like a single man for the first 12 years of his marriage to my mother. And so I lived in fear. And so the early days of beginning to try and understand how people operated was simply to protect myself, looking for cues in behavior, right? But that also meant that I became very withdrawn, very anxious child, and very, very introverted and observing. But then again, that gave me the tools that I use now to sit back and observe human behavior and go, why is that happening? Why is this person operating that way? So initially it was simply looking at action response and making sure I put myself in a space where I didn't come to harm. But over time, that grew to thinking about, okay, what's behind that action? Action is just surface level, but there's a motivation going on. So you come back to these things of what are the motivators behind these actions and how can we speak to those? How can we understand those better? And so I have, you know, a deal of empathy and compassion for my stepfather. He's passed on many years ago. But right up until his death, I still resented him, you know. It wasn't until relatively recently, I'll say 10, 12 years ago, that I kind of sat down and thought about how can I be grateful for this man in my life? What I perceived as trauma, that's a perception. What were the benefits to me of his interaction with me over the course of my life? And I see he taught me these skills of observing and questioning. When I became a teenager, we used to have these stand-up arguments because he had very different views from me. But that meant I learned how to research and think for myself and justify my position. And it never convinced him ever once.
What's an example? What's an example? I need to know what was the most heated debate in this house.
Look, my wife is an Indigenous Australian, right? She's an Aboriginal heritage. And my stepdad had very, very absolute firm views about interracial marriage, what he called interracial marriage. Absolutely against it.
And you would just intellectually argue why it didn't make sense
And spiritually, because we were at that stage, we were in a church that supported him and was using, you know, because you can make Bible say anything you want. So people were using Old Testament scriptures to support his position and demanding that I, you know, obey him because he's the head of the house, et cetera. So, you know, the kind of general patriarchal kind of constructs and children should be seen, not heard. And I pushed back against all of that. And I ran away from home, wrote him a horrible note that I think he burned.
Oh my gosh.
Right. We never saw eye to eye on that situation. But eventually, when I married Jen, was my girlfriend, then when we got married sometime later, he never apologized, but he said, okay, marriage is sacred. I can't change that. You can't get divorced. So we can't change it. I'll just accept it. So he never changed his belief, but he did learn to accept me and he accepted my wife. And then when we had kids, right, he suddenly fell in love with our grandkids. And that was one of the issues that he had initially. It was like, you know, I don't want to have any half-caste grandchildren. Right? It was just...
Right.
And yet when they started to come along, he fell in love with them. So it didn't change his views, but he loved them deeply, right? It's this weird, and this is this weird paradox about humans, right? We can hold these things that we say we believe and yet act
that is
different.
Such cognitive dissonance. I've never thought about the cognitive dissonance of a seemingly racist grandfather is really what it comes down to.
Maybe
I found the title of this episode. I don't know. No, but I mean, this is fascinating. That's got fascinating. I mean, were you ever sitting there going, he loves them, so he therefore doesn't have these beliefs, but also he has these beliefs, so he kind of hates them too. And also what it kind of makes me think of Bruce, and I know this is a much deeper conversation and much deeper than, you know, what two white men can speak to, but I'm going to say it kind of shows the fragility of racism. How, like, it's so just, it's such a construction of the mind that when the heart wins, the heart wins. People, when you love, that is a stronger thing than, well, I'm not supposed to like these things because they're different, and not when it's right in front of you. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you ever went down that rabbit hole of exploring that cognitive dissonance, but I've just never been confronted. The idea of your father holding your daughter is such a symbolic picture to me of the twisted nature of that paradox you described.
Yeah, I know. It's weirdly complex. And and my stepdad, you know, he deeply loved the grandkids when they came along. And one of my brothers married a beautiful Pakistani girl who was born in Dubai. And again, you know, those grandkids became part of the family. So I just find it humorous, right? The curiosity and a sense of humor are the two things that help us survive anything. Anything. If we can be curious, if we can have a sense of humor about it, you just got to laugh, right? Because what we resist persists. Mm. And so if we're afraid of something, and ultimately when you look at my stepdad, he had a fear. It was something he didn't understand or comprehend as different. And so we fear difference. And how I understand his position now is he was simply afraid. But when these human beings came into his life, he wasn't afraid of them. So it gave him an opportunity to love something he thought he couldn't love, but he still held this cognitive belief. You know, he still backed these really right-wing politicians throughout his whole life. It's weird stuff. So you just got to laugh and go, you know what? But we're all human, and all of us do this stuff. You know, we all say we believe something, but we act differently.
But this feels like a college academic late night dorm discussion, which I love. But it is interesting that groups of people, when you're thinking about people on the group level, you're more prone towards a really generalized thinking means inaccurate feeling in a lot of ways, or inaccurate to the way you would feel when confronted. The best example I can think of in the US is looking at all the Trump supporters or looking at all the liberals and the Democrats from the other angle as the group, and then meeting them one-on-one. Daryl Davis, he's a great example from the black man who went around to members of the KKK and one-on-one would sit with them and they'd take off their robes. Like, that is the perfect encapsulation of this, which makes me go, and I'm sure, first of all, this makes me think easy teams, you are dealing with this kind of mass perception of what the accounting department's like versus the sales department.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like you do
absolutely.
That. But second of all, is there a way that we really can affect a certain mind space? Is it possible for humans to really come in and have profound person-to-person empathy and break through the mass grouping efforts of the mind? That's what the mind is doing. The mind is creating groups. I feel it's not even disinformation that we have to wade through these days, Bruce. We have to wade through mindset tropes that are poisonous. If we get through that and we can just have the experience of holding our grandchild that may be a different race on a mass level, my gosh, what kind of world we'd live in. That's my stump speech. I don't know. I mean, what do you think about that? How do we get rid of that cognitive dissonance and just go right for the resonance, I suppose? I want to step right to resonance. I don't want the dissonance.
Yeah. Well, why did humans develop a limbic brain, right? We all started out with the dinosaur brain, the reptile brain, the lizard brain, which is purely reaction, and the fight or flight kind of responses. But over time, mammals developed the limbic brain, which is about connection and empathy and emotion. And, you know, is the difference between looking into the eyes of a shark, which has no limbic brain, compared to looking into the eyes of a puppy, which has a limbic brain. You sense, you almost sense love, right, from one, and just this cold-hearted killer in the other. Mm. Can we move? Really, what we're talking about is falling in love with people. It doesn't matter whether it's the corporate space, whether that's our families, whether that's our political system. But can we just love people, right? That's the deepest human need. Can we tap into that need and go, you know what? You're different from me, but when I get to know you, I think I could love you. I think I could accept you for who you are, because in doing that, it means I have to accept myself for who I am.
Yes.
Right, because what annoys us about people are the things that we don't admit about ourselves. Jung was the, you know, he raised that issue. He said, we don't see other people, we see our shadows falling over them. That is our shadow side. So we're all, and this is the thing about personality tests, right? It highlights all these wonderful things about us. But the real value is, well, what's the flip side of that? Every yin has its yang. All energy has both positive and negative poles. So if this is my strength, what is the corresponding weakness that comes with it that balances it? Hmm. Right. So let's explore those weaknesses and those tropes that we don't want to admit about ourselves. Is there something about a Democrat or a Republican that pisses us off? Well, before we, you know, cast the first stone, where do we have that same trait? All humans have the same human traits. We just demonstrate them differently and in different ways. I think that's the way to connect, is to find, if someone irritates me, then where do I do that same behavior in a different form, so that I can now recognize, okay, I have that same trait or trope or weakness that I perceive. How can I judge them for it? They're yeah. just as human as me. By the same token, people we admire and we look up to, we put them above ourselves, right? The people that we look down on, we put beneath ourselves and we think, I'm better than them. Yet if we explore that space and we go, you know what, where am I bigoted? Where am I thinking that people are less than or not as good as me? And when I find that, I can't be judgmental of someone else that might judge somebody about the color of their skin if I'm judging people about the level of their intellect, you know, or their bank account, or how much they've traveled, or how many books they've read, or whether they can read. Am I judging people in that space? Well, then I'm just still judging people. So how can I judge someone else who judges people? Because I do the same, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But equally, if I look at someone that I perceive is better than me, well, what is it that's inspiring me about that person? Because I guarantee, you know, if you spot it, you've got it. Whatever you see in someone, is you can only see that. And neurologically, psychologically, you can only see something in somebody that you recognize, right? You can't recognize something you don't already know.
Oh, interesting.
Right. How can you recognize something you don't? If you're walking through a crowd of strangers, they're all strangers, but you see someone you know, you recognize them. So when you see a trait in somebody that triggers something in you, whether it's positive or negative, it means that you know that trait, which means you've done it. So if I'm looking up at somebody, say I'm looking at Martin Luther King and I'm thinking, wow, what a fabulous orator, then, okay, where do I have the capacity to speak and persuade people or communicate a message that will help people understand themselves better? And when you see that, you go, you know, he's not better than me. He's just good at something that I'm also good at, but we do it in different ways.
Wow. That's a very positive perspective.
But this is, and again, like mirror neurons, right? I said neurologically, we're designed this way. Mirror neurons, when we learn a motor skill, we watch someone, mirror neurons fire with the motor neurons, connect. And we watch, and then we do the action. Say it's riding a bike, right? We've watched them ride a bike. The mirror neurons start to fire with the motor neurons, and we go, oh, yeah, okay, that's what it looks like. And then we get on a bike, and we start to do it, and the same neurons fire together. Then when we learn and we now know how to ride a bike, anytime we see someone ride a bike, the mirror neurons fire. And our brain doesn't know whether we're riding the bike or they are. It just feels like bike riding. This is why we get excited watching our football team win, right? Or our basketball team win. Why? Because we understand, you know, the movements that they're doing. And then when they score, we understand the joy of achievement. And so the mirror neurons in us fire and we feel the same emotion and elation that they feel.
Yeah.
This is empathy. So mirror neurons are where, how we develop the capacity for empathy. But it also means that if we think about that cognitively, like kind of marrying Jung's ideas and neurology, whatever we see is a representation of us.
This is next level, man. Connected. I love it.
Everything's connected, right? So whatever I see is telling me something about myself. It's telling me something about myself. If I react to it positively or negatively, the reaction tells me it means something to me. If it's making me angry, then there's a value set that's being triggered. If it makes me joyful, there's a value set that's being triggered. So I can understand my values by what affects me emotionally. And if I understand what affects me emotionally and that's triggering my value set, and I look at my value set and then I go, okay, these are my values and they're being triggered here. How is that happening? And I begin to question that interaction in myself, and now I can begin to understand this other person better. It creates an environment where we can connect, where now I can begin to ask them questions and the curiosity comes in and we can begin to explore and go, okay, there's some common ground here. We actually both feel very strongly about this thing. You feel the polar opposite to me about it, but we both feel very strongly about it. Well, at least we can agree on that. That's something.
I suppose the idea of having a capacity to recognize something as great, meaning that you might have the capacity to do it yourself, is something I've never considered before. I mean, I've certainly thought about it. Like if I see, as someone that studied acting, I look at people on stage that perform and I go, these guys are amazing and I want to be like that. But that's just something I'm interested in. What is the difference between looking at someone who is in the similar line of work versus a fan, would you say? Like, could a massive fan of Michael Jackson, do they see in themselves the potential to rock out a full crowd? What is the actual subtlety in what you're describing?
I think you need to go to the specific trait that you admire, right? So if they're just admiring his fame, that's ephemeral. You can be famous for almost anything. You can be famous for killing people. Look at Hitler, John Wilkes Booth. They're famous, but I don't think I want that particular set, right? But it's okay, if we're looking at Michael Jackson, what was it? Was it his singing? What is his dancing ability? Was it his capacity to just draw a crowd into where he was? How did he do that?
So it's almost the specificity with which you admire. Absolutely. Is the level of potential that you believe the person has to be able to, at least in their unique way, live up to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Whether we admire or despise somebody, there's a behavior that's triggering our response. So let's explore that behavior and go, well, what specifically are they doing in that moment that I think is good or bad? And once I identify that, where do I replicate that behavior in another form in my own life? And how can I now then, recognizing that behavior is there, how can I begin to leverage it and maximize it so it has greater impact? So, for example, we often admire people that are really, really well organized, right? They're very organized, focus on minute detail, deep level preparation, think of everything that could possibly go wrong and be super prepared with every single thing they need for this event that they want to create and the situation that they want to succeed in. And then they make sure that they put themselves in exactly the right environment with all the right tools at exactly the right time for when the person they want to interact with is going to be there, right? We admire all those traits.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. I just described a rapist.
Oh, God. Thanks for the mind F, man. Oh, jeez. No, you're right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Okay. So we're deeply offended by that behavior. But if we break it down into its component parts and we go, what are the traits? Well, where I do those traits in other forms, and it's not necessarily that I want to replicate the way that that person operates, because I don't want to cause that kind of harm and trauma to another person or be that selfish. But I can recognize those traits and go, okay, those are things that I've done or could do. By the same token, we can look at, at someone like Steve Jobs and how he's created Apple. And again, we've got this minute focus on detail and perfection that he brought to that space and created something really positive. But they're just human traits at two ends of the spectrum. So any human behavior can, we just need to dig into it and go, okay, what is that person doing and where do I do that in another form? And in the case of somebody that's doing harm to another human, then where have I perhaps done that to other people? I've worked in the past in the personal space with some coaching with people of people who've been through deep trauma, like incest or rape. I've worked with a family where the son actually murdered his girlfriend and was in jail, and worked with both him and his sister to come through that, right? And that's not a space that people want to work in, but to be able to do that, I first had to not have any judgment for those people. So I need to look at, well, where am I that kind of person? Where do I have the potential capacity to cause that kind of harm to another human being? Where have I hated somebody so much I wanted them dead? That's been there in my life, right? I had that as a 9-year-old kid, hearing my stepdad, and my mom interacting, and her in tears. I lay in my bed as a 9-year-old, wishing I could grow up faster so I could kill him. Now I have to acknowledge that about myself, that I had the capacity to do that kind of harm to another human being with deep levels of hatred. To say, yeah, I'm capable of that. I'm as human as that. To be able to then find that the compassion to love that person as well on the other side and go, you know what, he was still a gift to my life because he taught me invaluable skills that I use in every aspect of my day-to-day living. And even though we never saw eye to eye and we still conflicted, but that conflict created a space where I could learn and grow, and that's valuable, so I can love him and appreciate him. Even though he never grew out of that fear that he lived with, that was his hell. Right? That was his hell. And he never knew how to move beyond that. And he lived a small life because of it. But again, that was his choice to do that. So I can still feel compassion for him and I can feel deep love for him. So we are these massive contradictions and paradoxes. And unless we can recognize that about ourselves, how can we possibly reach out and help another human being?
I mean, I really wonder if someone came to you and you didn't have that feeling, do you ever go, yeah, I'm not that person because I've never felt that I could kill another human?
We need to be at peace with who we are and to be able to help other people, right? And that doesn't mean I can help everybody and anybody, because there's some people I don't want to work with. I choose not to work with people that are just out to make money at everybody's expense. I could work through that emotional reaction to that, but I don't want to put the effort into that. There are plenty of people around who don't have that value set, and it's easier for me, selfish of me, I know, but it's easier for me to just find those people and work with them because they're a lot more fun to work with.
Yes.
Right. So we still make all these selfish decisions. We still move towards pleasure and away from pain. And that's okay, because that's still human. But let's find that space where we bring, what do we leave behind us when we go? I want to leave behind stories that are worth retelling and a contribution that's made a difference. So I want to find that space where I can do that. You're finding that with a podcast, right? You're asking questions and opening people's minds up to ideas that they'd probably never considered before. And that's it's making a contribution, that's making a difference, that's meaningful and important. You may never work with the kind of people I work with. I will probably never speak to some of the people that you speak to, but that's okay, right?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, you talk to dancers. I mean, that's kind of in the fringe circuit. Well, maybe not. Maybe not. I mean, look, are they more connected when you work with an exotic dancer? And just so everybody's listening can understand, I don't think they were all strippers. I think adult dancing could have been belly dancers for all we know. And there's no judgment. I have no judgment for anybody in that industry. I actually welcome and am fascinated by people that are, as a performing artist, I know how rough it is out there. And that is it can be rough psychologically for those people because they are in their bodies. Exotic dancers, they are in their bodies. They are less heady than lawyers for sure. But what are the corporate problems of the exotic dancer, you would say, when you encounter like a group like that? Do you remember?
They're no different to any other business. It's a business like any other. It's about lead generation and sales.
Yeah.
So that's their goal on every night is to generate interest, make a connection, and then turn that conversation into a sale. And there's a spectrum of services that can be provided, you know, and that may be dancing, that may be something more intimate.
Were you actually working with them on that level? You were talking about the conversation that they were having with prospects.
I was working with one particular dancer for a while. I gotta say, it's not a regular kind of client, right? This is some time ago, but yeah. So that was her challenge, right? How to make a living and do it really well.
I'm just fascinated. How'd she find you? You're this corporate guy, and all of a sudden she's like, you know, looking for you for corporate. I mean, I feel like it's kind of a smart move. I would think if you were an exotic dancer, you'd want a really good sales trainer.
At that time, I wasn't working so much with businesses. I was doing a lot more personal coaching in those days. And yeah. I don't know if you know a guy called John DeMartini.
Yeah, he keeps being brought up. I mean, because we have a mutual connection, Shannon Eastman. So everybody brings up this guy. This guy's like the legendary man.
This is where I met that particular young lady, and we were both involved with John's programs. I actually facilitated for him in Australia for all his programs for about a period of about 4 years. And yeah, he's a fascinating guy, and a lot of the principles that I'm talking about are principles that he teaches. He's synthesized a lot of really, really fascinating ideas. But, you know, when you dig behind it, it's you know, it's panpsychism, it's Zen Buddhism, it's, you know, these ideas are not new. They've been around for millennia. You know, you'd read Rumi and hear these same principles. You know, there's a field beyond right and wrong, and I'll meet you there, right? That's what we're talking about.
Yes, yes.
Shakespeare said, you know, a thing is only, nothing is good or bad except thinking makes it so. We make these value judgments about everything. You know, Trump bad, Biden good, or vice versa. These are based on internal value judgments, and every one of us are unique. If there's 8 billion people on the planet, there's 8 billion perceptions of reality and 8 billion value sets. If I'm living in a shanty town in South Africa, then just making enough to buy basic food for my family is a huge value set, not so much for me living on, you know, where I am in Australia and next to a beach, you know, in a beautiful apartment, and I have a car and employment, you know, so my values are different, but they drive me in the same way that someone in that space might, or they drive me in the same way that someone in a corporate position or, you know, who's just an entrepreneur trying to create something new for the planet. We're all driven by things that interest us. Is it deGrasse Tyson, you know,
astrophysicist.
He said, we follow what feeds our worldview. So this idea of confirmation bias always gets a bad rap, but confirmation bias, why is it there? I'm focused on things that interest me. So if those things get my attention, there's something it can teach me about myself, which means it can teach me about why I'm here. I'm looping back to that idea that, so if my value set draws my attention in particular ways to certain people or events or ideas, then why don't I follow that and see where it takes me? You know, those are the open loops to explore and go, wow, there's a mystery beyond my history, and let me see what this thing is. Where is this leading me? Where is this taking me?
First of all, I love that you admitted to me that you put on a personality tests to get them through the door on your website. Yeah, you want a personality test? Let's get on the phone and talk. You don't want this, and let me tell you why. That's hilarious to me. But also, you are speaking about values quite a bit. And I know the last thing you have, which actually, I was going on your website and I was looking at the assessment tools, and your values assessment test actually is easyteams.coms. Like, that is your thing. You've spoken about inner values and following your values. This is something I wrestled with a lot in 2019, end of 2019, when I didn't feel like I had a purpose or a podcast or something to do, which is figuring out my values and finding those. How important is that to you? Does it have to be that explicit to take an assessment to identify those, or is there an easier way to identify them so then you can live them?
Yeah, what we're talking about is that everything is telling us what our values are. Everything we look at, right? The things that inspire us, the things that cause a negative reaction, they're telling us that's something that's important to me. That is a value for me. So we don't necessarily need to do a values assessment. I often tell people, look, time, energy, and money are the three key indicators of where your values lie. Gandhi said that our actions demonstrate our priorities. So what we take action on, what we spend money on, what we put our energy into, what we use our time for, those things indicate what we really value. I think a lot of people talk about values, they're really talking about social virtues. Right? We talk about harmony, collaboration, honesty, authenticity. These are social virtues. But there's times when you can't be honest with people. You can't tell them the exact truth because it's actually going to be quite painful either for you or them. So these social virtues are there so we operate as a collective. But my personal values could be very different. You know, you can go to every room in my house and there are books. That's a value for me. I see behind you, you have books, right? There's a value. So reading, everywhere. Learning, right? And if I looked at your bank account, there'd be, you know, purchases from Amazon or similar constantly. And you go, okay, this guy likes reading. He likes learning. He likes developing his mind. There's a value set there. You can visit one of my daughters and her closet will be filled with fashion and shoes. That's a value. That's a value. That's a driver. That's a motivator for her to do well at her job so she can earn the income to buy these things and make her feel good. Who am I to question that value? I'm very minimalist when it comes to clothes. For her, that's a real value.
Have you ever met someone, I'm just curious, have you ever met someone that walks through the world that isn't aware of their inner values, but is still a functional
every day,
but is functional human, is doing okay, but they have no idea what they want. They just kind of follow it. They've probably never done an assessment on this. They've never done a personality test, yet they're still pursuing their values. How does that person do it?
Well, then understanding them intrinsically or intuitively. And so they know this thing is important to me, so I'm going to pursue it. It's not all of us have to understand and articulate them, but you could see people, pet owners, you know, if you said you have a value on dogs, they go, what are you talking about?
Right.
You know, so there are value sets that drive us to certain behaviors, whether we're conscious of them or not, because they are unconscious. Where it's helpful is if we want to shift our achievement in a particular domain of our life, if we want to shift our level of success and achievement in relationships or in spirituality or in finance or career, then getting greater clarity around what my value set are helps me understand my motivators. And I think it's David Allen, who's a really interesting guy in terms of time management. He says people have only got two problems. They either don't know what they want or they don't know how to get what they want. And so values help us understand what we want. Some people are unclear about that. So they're just running around doing all sorts of things and not really getting anywhere. So for some people, the clarity around the values gives them clarity around what they actually want, which gives them direction. They can make better decisions, move in the direction of their dreams. other people, they already understand what they want. So now their question is the other one, or how do I get what they want? So they just focus on that. Yeah. And then again, on the other side of things, particularly in a, if I'm working in a group situation, or, you know, whether that's a family or a business, if we want to adjust the behavior in that group that we're part of, again, some people are unaware of the values that are required, in which case we need to unsettle them enough to that they begin to recognize them. You know, people are either unaware of their problem or insufficiently disturbed by it. So my job often when I'm working with people is to, one, make them aware of their issue, and two, to disturb them enough that they'll do something about it.
I was going to end this interview by asking, has Bruce Williams found empathy? But I don't. Now that you said that, I mean, I think he knows how to pretend it very well. No, I do think I do think you're a heartful person. I do. I'm messing around. But I mean, yeah, where are you on the spectrum of, do you think you've slid on the spectrum these days? Do you feel like... I do see love. I do see love radiating from you, despite what you may think. I'm curious if that is the journey down the pathy is like where you're at.
Yeah.
Is that really where it comes down to? Where it comes down to? Like, where do you feel like you've landed?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I have a deep sense of love and empathy for people. It's just that what I realized is I didn't really understand how to express it.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? So often, and people that are in their head a lot are trying to suppress that humanness because it interferes with our logic and our decision making. And, you know, these are the goals I need to achieve and I need to push, not realizing that they're undermining their health, their well-being, their psychological well-being, etc. Those are the lessons I've learned through burning out multiple times in my career.
Yeah.
Right. So, I have deep levels of empathy, you know, but over my lifetime, there were certain habits that I'd developed, which perhaps kept that behind a shield to keep myself safe. So, and this is where I love the work of Brené Brown, you know, is bringing down those shields and going, you know, okay, but I can be open and vulnerable in this space. And it doesn't mean to just be, you know, completely open and vulnerable to everybody, because there's people who take advantage of that. But yeah. We all have that capacity for love and empathy, and we all have that need for love and empathy. And that's the direction that if we move in that, whether that's business, family, spirituality, if we move in that direction, you know, and find that inner balance and peace with ourselves, we can have greater empathy and peace with other people who are perhaps a bit different from us.
Yeah. You know, you started this by talking about Einstein and then saying it was a woman who actually created the quote and what that stuff. And you talked about purpose and contribution. As you're moving into whichever field you go next, Bruce, what is the contribution you're hoping to make?
Stories worth retelling. I think we are our stories. We've just been swapping stories here.
Yeah.
And Roger C. Shank, who was one of the early explorers of artificial intelligence, he was trying to figure out how to make computers think like humans. And what he discovered was that humans are not designed to process logic. We're designed to process stories. And so he started to understand that artificial intelligence needed to be able to understand how to explain stories and make emotional connections. What's really fascinating is Shank, once he began to understand that, shifted completely across into the educational space. And he's now a huge proponent, supporter of storytelling as an educational tool. And I think the contribution I'd like to make is to leave behind some stories. Where am I going in the next 10 years? We talk about who inspires you. I'm inspired by books, and I thought, well, what if I could become an author? What would that look like?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. When are the dates on this book?
It's been pushed back a little bit by COVID because I've had to focus on some other things. But yeah, sometime next year, maybe mid next year, I'll have the first book will come out. But my goal is to write as many books as I can before I'm 70, so that then that becomes who I am at that point, right? Told my kids I'm aiming for 100 and in terms of years of age.
Yeah.
And who knows what medicine and science will be doing at that stage. So I'll keep my, you know, I'll keep an option for an extra 25, maybe, if that's possible. But who knows what's possible for us as humans, right?
Right.
How many, so I want to find stories that help people understand themselves, believe in themselves, accept themselves for who they are, and go, you know what, I'm okay. There's a beautiful prayer that I forget who said it, but it's along the lines of, may God grant you the grace to believe the truth about yourself, no matter how beautiful it is. I think that's the message people need to hear. You know, you're beautiful just as you are. You don't need to be like anybody else because you're not like them. But who you are is absolutely perfect. And if you can embrace that and be that, you will bring something positive into the world that no one else could bring, because how could they? They're not you.
Wow. Wow. Thank you. Look, I'm signing up for your church services again. Go back. Let's do it. Bruce Williams, who knows? I mean, next week, this website might not exist. He could have already moved on. easyteams.com.au. I know you're not promoting anything, but if this man's message resonated with you at all, that's where you can find him. Yeah, Bruce, I really appreciated you coming on. I thought this was a heartwarming message. Or just a, well, I don't know. You weren't a Hallmark card. This was a heart enlivening conversation that was loopy. And that's all I really want on this show. So thank you so much for coming on. This was awesome. I really learned a lot and was enlightened.
Greg, thank you so much. I mean, yeah, you just asked some really fascinating questions. I think that's a beautiful thing. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I love what you do. I think what you're creating here is just so fabulous. Well done.
Awesome. Thank you. As I'm sure you can tell, my favorite part of that interview was being told that the entire personality test thing was just a ruse. I love that stuff. It's as if it's a Hitchcock movie and you have the MacGuffin. For those of you that don't know the term MacGuffin, it's the object that people are focused on. The Ark of the Covenant, the Holy Grail in what is it? Psycho. There's the money in the newspaper. It's the thing that starts the journey that you think the story's about, but really it's about everything that happens around it. Term that came from Alfred Hitchcock, specifically with Psycho, because the MacGuffin, complete misdirect. Love that. Love that Bruce uses it, and sounds like he's using it effectively. Certainly spun me in different directions that I was expecting. Love it. Since I've did this interview, I've gone even deeper into John DeMartini's work on values. And Bruce is an amazing advocate on behalf of it. He really knows what he's talking about. Getting to those core values is so, so important. And the key is, it doesn't matter if you're paying attention to it or not. You're always living it. Bruce, thank you for living a heart-filled life, for being on my show. And for those of you listening, if you enjoyed this episode, please make sure to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It's been a pleasure. I'll talk to you soon.